From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the move towards autonomous vehicles like an automotive wild, wild west.
This whole notion that we want to think here in Detroit that General Motors and Ford are going to end up on top of this thing is by no means certain.
Michigan and Michigan State, the first ever night game. Ann Arbor and East Lansing officials are bracing themselves.
That's a whole day of pregaming, and they don't like it.
He once led AOL. Now Steve Case is coming to Ann Arbor to boost Michigan entrepreneurs.
It's important that we really level the playing field so everybody, everywhere, really has a shot at the American dream.
And the challenge of helping youngsters born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
How can we best support and not blame the child for what's essentially many people call a head injury that happened before birth?
Those stories today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the wake of the Las Vegas massacre, we'll revisit the debate over guns that was happening in Michigan nearly 20 years ago and figure out why the gun control movement here still hasn't recovered. But first, in the past 5 years, at least 18 people have died in the Macomb County Jail. That's a higher rate than state and national averages. It's a complex situation, but there are two clear contributing factors. The jail has a chronic overcrowding problem, and Macomb County has been hard hit by the opioid addiction crisis. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has the story of one woman who died there and her family's effort to raise alarms about what's going on.
It was July 7th, 2013. Diane Hubble had been making mulberry jam at her son's house.
I came home and the sheriff's car was blocking our driveway, still running.
Diane knew immediately that something was very wrong and that it had to do with her daughter, Jennifer Myers. Jennifer was in the Macomb County Jail again. She was a heroin addict and she'd been in and out of jail more times than her family could count. By the time Diane walked into the living room, the sheriff's deputies had already told her husband, Russ, that Jennifer was dead.
They just told us that, well, she was at breakfast, she was at lunch, and we found her dead in her cell.
Jennifer was the oldest of Russ and Diane's three children, and she left behind three children of her own. They were all shocked by her death, but not terribly surprised. Jennifer was only 37, but addiction had taken a serious toll on her body. They were left with the impression she died suddenly and had no reason to doubt that. Jennifer's dad, Russ, says he assumed what most people do. Your addicted loved one is safer in jail than on the street.
So you think they're in the jail, no drug dealers are going to show up and give them drugs. They're going to have to go through a detoxification. You sleep. I mean, you sleep through the night where you haven't been sleeping when you know they're in there.
Months went by before Jennifer's death certificate arrived. It revealed her official cause of death was acute sepsis. Diane processes medical claims, so Russ says she knew immediately something wasn't right.
She said, wait a minute, that takes hours or days, or it's not something where you could have had a heart attack.
Around the same time, they started to hear rumors. One night, Diane ran into a woman who'd known Jennifer.
She went back, and that's when the woman says, you know, Jennifer was really sick before she died.
They found out that other women who'd been in jail with her were looking for them, too. They told similar stories. Kimberly Eland was in the cell block next to Jennifer's. Eland says she was really obviously sick, and not normal detoxing sick.
It was very clear. She was discolored. She was hung over her over the bin, and she was literally coughing up fluid.
She was too weak to get up and get her own food, and there was a horrible smell coming from her body. Eland says, and records now show, that Jennifer and her fellow inmates requested medical attention, repeatedly. But as she got worse, medical staff stopped responding. Then on July 7th, she was found dead alone in her cell.
We watched the guards come in and the nurses come in, and then we watched the coroner come in and take her out in a body bag.
Russ Hubble says hearing this over and over again was really hard to take. He and Diane debated what to do for a long time.
Because it's very shocking and it's very upsetting. And my grandchildren don't need to know this if we can't do something with this information.
In 2016, more than 3 years after Jennifer's death, they did do something. The Hubbles filed a federal lawsuit against Macomb County, among others. It's one of seven federal lawsuits Macomb County has faced over jail deaths since Jennifer's in 2013.
A developing story now as the Macomb County Sheriff declares an overcrowding emergency at that jail.
That story from Detroit's WXYZ-TV is from September 2013, about 2 months after Jennifer Myers died. It was the first jail overcrowding emergency Sheriff Anthony Wickersham had to declare. There was another one in 2014 and another in 2015. Experts say the evidence about jail crowding is very clear. It sharply raises the risk of violence, suicide, and serious illness among inmates. But Wickersham says there's little he can do about that right now.
As sheriff, I really have limited control on who comes to jail. Police officers in Macomb County and my deputies are arresting individuals, and once they go in front of the judges, the judges decide who goes to jail and who goes home.
Wickersham says overcrowding problems at the jail go back more than a decade. In 2014, he and other county leaders asked outside consultants to recommend long-term solutions. That report makes a lot of findings about the jail and Macomb County's justice system in general. Among them, the terrible impact of drugs. Of the 18 deaths since 2012, at least three are known to be from drug overdoses inside the jail. One of them was Daniel Byrd. His niece, Melinda Odisho, is also suing the county.
I do find the common denominator is some form of opiate, heroin addiction.
Wickersham says at any given time, more than 70% of the jail's population has some kind of substance abuse problem. If you throw in mental illness, that's really most of the people locked up there.
In reality, there's a lot of sick people here. A lot of sick people that would never go see a doctor on the outside.
Wickersham wouldn't comment on any specific cases, including Jennifer Myers. He says more inmates are being sent to the hospital for medical care now, and that's true. But otherwise, Wickersham says he doesn't see major problems with how the jail's being run. Russ Hubble thinks that's shocking. He was sure his daughter's death, the way she and others died in the jail, would at least force a harsh reckoning there.
You think, boy, there's going to be a major upheaval over there. I mean, this is going to bring about, you know, an investigation
change.
Like you wouldn't believe and change.
But there's been nothing like that. Diane Hubble says the jail needs more humane ways to treat detoxing addicts. And most jail and medical staff just need to do more and care more about the suffering they see.
It's not just, oh, well, that's an addict. It's no big deal. There are signs, and especially in Jennifer's case, had her vitals been taken, it would have been recognized. It should have been recognized.
Diane and Russ are normally private people, but after Jennifer died, they became activists. They go to addiction trainings and rallies and vigils and to regular protests outside the Macomb County Jail because they don't want anyone else to die there like Jennifer did. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll talk to Sarah about how Macomb County courts are contributing to the jail's overcrowding problem. Time now to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. 7:30 Saturday night at the Big House. A lot of folks in this state will be fixed on the annual clash between Michigan and Michigan State. First off, a night game, first ever.
First ever, and they've been playing since 1898.
How'd this come about?
TV money. It's a very simple answer. And people, of course, want to get mad at TV for pushing the kickoff. They're dying for a night game. They love night games, of course. They get better ratings. You spread the schedule out. You got a 12 o'clock game, a 3:30 game, a 7:30 game. They rack it up all day long. Don't get mad at them. All they can do is offer the money.
Yeah.
The universities take it. And once you take it on a condition. And this is the condition. They decide your kickoff times. This is a noted contrast to the past. Don Canham, the old AD at Michigan, they were dying for night games back then, too. ABC was, and they're pushing Canham. And as he said, they wanted one. I didn't want one. So we compromised and didn't have one.
And Bo had a famous comment. Go ahead.
Toe meets leather at 105. You want to tape it? That's great. If you don't, that's fine, too. And their philosophy was correct, in my opinion. If 100,000 people are watching anything live, TV will show up. Mm. Organically, magically. TV cannot let a thing like that go untelevised.
How's the reaction been among fans?
Mixed. And it's about a 25-year gap. Below 25, you love it. And above 25, you got to drive home to Grand Rapids, man.
Yeah. Now, I'm thinking of officials in Ann Arbor and East Lansing because, boy, a 7:30 p.m. start means a lot of pre-gaming.
That's a whole day of pre-gaming, and they don't like it. Mm. They also don't like to drive home, of course, and you don't have too many roads leaving Ann Arbor to get that many people out. In addition to the 100,000 people who show up for this game, 100,000 more come to town to party.
Oh, boy.
So your population basically triples in one day. That's not healthy.
Where do you put Michigan-Michigan State in the pantheon of great sports rivalries?
It's underrated. It does not get the attention that it deserves nationally. Obviously, Michigan sees Ohio State as the main rival, and that has been true forever. But this thing is a very serious rivalry. It's gotten much better in the last decade, thanks to Mark D'Antonio at Michigan State. Now Michigan's upholding its end of the deal. It often has a big impact on the Big Ten race. And right now, man, Michigan State's 3-1. So last year, they're 3-9.
Yes, this is a different team than that sad sack team of last season.
This is going back to what D'Antonio does, blocking and tackling. Fundamentals, not flashy. They're not a great team. But they're good enough to give Michigan a very real scare, and they could pull it off.
What do you feel when you take a look at, if, for example, the quarterbacks as they're facing? What do you think? What do you see in both?
Michigan State's quarterback has got good experience, but he's not a great quarterback, but he's been there. Michigan's quarterback has got no experience almost.
In this game, yeah.
John O'Korn, he started a year ago against Indiana, not so good in that game. He filled in 2 weeks ago when Wilton Spate got injured at Michigan, and now he's your substitute quarterback, basically. So he's going to see a lot of blitzes from Michigan State. Anything they can do to rattle the new guy's cage, they're going to do it.
How about between Harbaugh and D'Antonio? Is there different approaches?
Different approaches, but they are both, in my opinion, top 10 coaches. I'm not kidding. These guys, the state has never been better served by its coaches than it is right now, frankly. So D'Antonio is meat and potatoes, you know, blocking and tackling. Harbaugh's got that on the defensive side. Michigan's defense might be the best defense in the country right now. It is that good. Offense has been struggling to find its rhythm. But Jim will throw more looks at you than D'Antonio will.
Yeah, well, indeed. So it sounds like you're expecting a really, really hard-fought good game.
It'll be a hard-fought game. When I talk to the Michigan players from the 70s, 80s, 90s, when Michigan was dominant during that time, they all tell me they felt worse on Sunday after a game against Michigan State than they did against Ohio State, which to me speaks volumes. This is not a friendly rivalry.
Want to make your prediction?
I bet the first half is going to be nip and tuck and back and forth. I think third and fourth quarter, I think Michigan takes over.
Well, we will wait and see. Want to give us any...
28-14.
All right, we shall see. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
Still to come, the challenge of helping youngsters who are born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
But it's not the behavior. We have to really step back and say, hey, we have to change the way we think about this. How can we best support this child in the classroom? How can we best support this young adult as they start their work life?
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
Next Wednesday, entrepreneur Steve Case will be in Ann Arbor promoting an initiative he calls Rise of the Rest. It's a day-long event including breakfast with political and business leaders, visits to various local startups, a fireside chat, and a startup pitch competition. The winner is awarded $100,000. Steve Case is visiting a total of 5 areas on this tour, and what they all have in common is that they're not necessarily considered fertile startup territory. Steve Case is probably best known as the previous leader of AOL. These days, he heads a venture capital firm called Revolution LLC. It pledges to help fund emerging startup ecosystems. Steve Case, welcome to The Next Idea.
Great to be with you.
Why'd you pick Ann Arbor as one of the 5 stops?
Because it's really emerging as a strong startup city. It's sort of the center of gravity in terms of a lot of the innovation in Michigan, and there's more and more people around the country are beginning to understand there are great startups there. But as the entrepreneurs in Ann Arbor tell us, it is harder to raise the venture capital needed to, you know, start a company or scale a company. So there's good progress. It is rising, but we're trying to kind of give it a little bit of a boost and tell the stories of Ann Arbor as a city, but also some of the entrepreneurs in the region and get more people paying attention. It's a lot of great things happening in places like Silicon Valley, but there are also great things happening in places like Ann Arbor, and everybody talks about Silicon Valley. Not that many people talk about Ann Arbor, so we're trying to do what we can to help change that.
Yeah, because traditionally these high-growth companies, you think of them being on the coast, but Rise of the Rest really seems to be wanting to change that conversation. Why is that important to you?
Well, I think it's important that we really level the playing field so everybody everywhere really has a shot at the American dream. It really has, if they have an idea, a shot of turning that idea into a company that can then create jobs in the community and economic growth in the community. If we're just backing the entrepreneurs on the coast, and right now the data is pretty sobering. Last year, 75% of venture capital went to just three states. And so 47 states, including Michigan, fought over 25%. That basically means we're backing them and helping create jobs there, but we're not helping the entrepreneurs in many parts of the country. I think we've got to change that, and there are a lot of great companies that are emerging in these Rise of the Rest cities, and we're just trying to do what we can to catalyze more interest and more support of those entrepreneurs.
So the winner of the startup pitch competition wins $100,000. What are you hoping this might do for whomever wins the Ann Arbor pitch competition?
Well, we've so far done these pitch competitions, these Rise of the Rest visits to 26 cities, 6,000 miles, the last 3 years or so. So we've gone to all kinds of different parts of the country. And as you said in the intro, we do a lot of things during the day in terms of trying to bring people together and visit companies and so forth. But we do in the afternoon, by the way, we're going to do it next Wednesday at the Michigan Theater starting around 3 o'clock. So people will love to see them come out for that. We basically have 8 or 9 companies pitching, but over 100 companies have applied to pitch, and we pick the best. And so all of them get that showcase, if you will. Hopefully there'll be people in the audience who want to be, you know, customers or want to be investors or want to be mentors. And the winner, you know, will obviously get more attention. And what we found in other cities, that the attention that winner gets often leads to partnerships or more investment from others and kind of helps those companies kind of get to the next level. And so it's not just about the $100,000 we invest, it's how we spotlight the, you know, the winner and get other people, whether in the community or around the, you know, country, to rally around to also help support and help build the company.
You've been doing this a while. This is the 6th Rise of the Rest tour for you. Can you give us an example of one previous winner that you think really exemplifies the kind of company you want to see benefit from these events?
Well, we like variety. In different parts of the country, we've seen different things. You know, ag tech, for example, in Lincoln, Nebraska, educational technology in New Orleans, water technologies in Albuquerque. So every city's a little different. We kind of like that. We like something that's unique to the area. But one example is the winner of our competition in Atlanta was a company called ParkPick, a really interesting way to use essentially same kind of technology Shazam uses to identify music, to identify parts, and it makes it easier to order the part you need. You know, that company, after getting our investment, got some investment from others and ended up being acquired by Amazon. So it went from being a company that nobody really knew about to a company that was on the map doing something interesting in that particular case, kind of helping people manage the supply chain. So we like the variety. We like the fact that there are different entrepreneurs doing different things in different parts of the country, and it's always fun to see firsthand what's happening in each of these cities and better understand some of the opportunities that are being pursued by entrepreneurs in these Rise of the Rest cities.
Steve Case is bringing Rise of the Rest to Ann Arbor Wednesday, October 11th. Michigan Theater is where it is. It's free and open to the public. You can get information by going to riseofrest.com. Steve Case, thanks so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Look forward to seeing you in Ann Arbor.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
There can be a sadness and pain that descends upon a family when a child is diagnosed with a neurological disability. Well, then imagine adding to that by realizing the child's disability is 100% incurable and 100% preventable. And that's the case with FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Ann Corrales is with the Michigan FASD Task Force and Associate Director of Research at Wayne State University's Developmental Disabilities Institute. And Julene Lloyd is a nurse, and she's the adoptive mother of a son who has FASD. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's get some basic facts about FASD, about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. What does that term actually cover?
So when we talk about a spectrum disorder, it usually covers what we call fetal alcohol syndrome, alcohol-related birth defects, and alcohol-related neurological developmental disabilities.
So meaning what kinds of symptoms, what kind of behaviors?
So you would see things around difficulty with learning, difficulty with memory, what we call executive functioning, you know, being able to kind of manage your life. You know I have to do this, so I get up on time to do that. Other things like social skills are affected. In particular, sometimes we see math skills or something that these kids may struggle with.
And this is permanent brain damage.
Yes, it is.
And it's 100% preventable because?
Because if the woman doesn't drink while she's pregnant, then the developing fetus is not affected by prenatal alcohol exposure.
And can this happen from a woman taking any drink at any time in her pregnancy? What do we know about this?
So what we know is that we don't know How much at what points in the pregnancy. We know some things like binge drinking is particularly harmful, but because each pregnancy is different and each woman's metabolism is different, we really can't say for sure that if you have one or two drinks, it's okay. So what we usually say is, why take the risk? If you're wanting to become pregnant, you should stop drinking, basically, and not drink through your pregnancy.
Julian, you've been living with what FASD can mean for a child and for a family, and you didn't suspect this until your son was older, correct?
Correct. We adopted him when he was younger, and we always knew it was a possibility, but, you know, after talking to the workers, it was, you know, determined, no, he probably doesn't have the symptoms of that at the time.
Why did you know it was a possibility?
Just because of history that we knew of the mother.
So how long did it take, Julian, going from when you first realized that things just weren't right in some way? How long did it take before someone finally said those words, FASD?
You know, initially the symptoms that we started, that I look back on now and realize are symptoms, were probably when he was in about third and fourth grade, when he just started getting agitated a little bit quicker than other kids and just started having problems in school. The real declines were later on than that. But it wasn't until he was 15 that I went to a support group for adoptive families, just not knowing where to turn or what to do. And the therapies that we were doing weren't working, and at school, the plans weren't working. And it was at that point someone said, have you considered FASD? And that's when I started exploring it and realizing that did make sense.
And you'd gone from counselors to psychiatrists. And am I correct that the words FASD came from a mom, not a mental health professional?
Yes, it was a mom that said that to me.
And is it typical to have such a long, difficult spell nailing down that diagnosis?
It is, unfortunately, and I think that's due to, one is that there's still not a widespread knowledge of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders out there kind of in society. It's not something that we have put a focus on.
Not like autism spectrum disorders.
Where, yeah. And the latest study says it could be 1 in 20 to 1 in 50 children has a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, so that's higher than autism spectrum disorders. And we know that 1 in 10 pregnant women drink and that 3% binge drink. So when it comes to the families, it is these family support groups that will often say, hey, what do you think? Because, you know, or the parent starts reading or talks to someone and gets the information and starts thinking, oh, my child seems to have those kind of symptoms. And yes, I suspect, or I do know that there was drinking during the pregnancy. We do have diagnostic centers or clinics that are attached to usually a genetics clinic in 6 places in Michigan. But they're, of course, they have huge wait lists. They don't get much money to do this work, and so they have to kind of fit it in. So it's unfortunate because it does, the earlier the intervention, the better the child and the family will do.
So early intervention can make
a
difference.
Yes, it can.
And I got to say, I'm going to tell you that I, too, am an adoptee. And so I know very well that medical background information can be sparse or non-existent.
Yes, right.
But this is not only an adoption issue, correct, Anne?
No, it's not. Because another thing we know, which most people don't know, is that the group of women who drink the most, the pregnant women, are white women who are educated. But that doesn't seem to come to the attention as much as adoptive and foster care, who are taken care of by public service, you know, the child welfare services. So those kind of do tend to come to the attention of the public. But there is a very high rate of FASDs in that population. Again, it could be up to 70% of children.
70%
yes,
of children?
That's what some of the research has said, yes.
70% of children?
70% in foster care.
In the foster care system.
Yeah.
And what do we know about prison rates?
Right. Well, so we don't have a lot of studies in this country, but some of the studies in Canada who looked at juveniles involved in the criminal justice system say about 25%. And we did a local study here in Washtenaw County several years ago that the parent support group did, and they found about that same rate, too, in our own local jail.
We do know that they say on the NOFAS website, which is the national organization website that discusses fetal alcohol spectrum, that 35% of the people that have an FASD have been in jail or prison.
And do we have an overall idea what percentage of children have been prenatally exposed to alcohol?
So the study that was just done a couple years ago by Philip May, he says between 2 and 5%.
And as far as women drinking. You noted, so it's about a national rate, about 90% say they don't drink, which means about 1 in 10.
Right.
But here in Michigan, we're at about 81%. Why is that, do you think?
Well, there's different, there's variation across the states. And I'm not sure why in Michigan there would be this higher rate of drinking among women, but there's probably, I think education and, you know, prevention types of things would certainly help if we did more of that.
Julian, what did you do to support your son once it was clear that you were indeed dealing with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? What'd you do to support him, and how is he doing today?
He's doing pretty good today. The biggest thing that we did was change schools. We realized that the pressure of being in a big public school, although they were, you know, trying to get supports for him in place, it was just too big of an environment. So we were able to get him into a small private school that has very small classroom size, and they work with kids that have learning disabilities. And that probably was the biggest change that we were able to do to help him, just to take some of the pressure off, which also helped relieve some of the stress at home as well.
We're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders with Julian Lloyd, who is a nurse and the adoptive mother of a son with FASD, and with Ann Corellis with the Michigan FASD Task Force. What is, Ann, the most direct and impactful way to get the message to women, to pregnant women, that that drink you're enjoying could have a terrible and lifelong effect on your unborn child?
Well, I think a couple of things. Some women don't get to the doctor, so, but I think the first line of defense is having physicians ask, you know, are you drinking and can we help, you know, let's talk about that and try to, you know, understand better what's going on. And if the person has a substance use disorder, get them some help.
Do we think they'll be honest? There's shame involved.
Yeah,
there's social stigma.
There is a lot of stigma. I think we need to work at that and say, you know, this isn't no shame, no blame. We want to educate and help women, because there's no woman who would ever try to intentionally, I think, hurt their, you know, baby is that growing inside them. I think it's a lot of not having the information or not having the right supports. And the other thing is we're looking at doing, you know, a public campaign of having signs up at point of sale, so in the grocery store and bars that talk about this.
Do we really know if point of sale warning signs will move the needle? I mean, I'm thinking of this, of what was on cigarette packs, you know, the Surgeon General has declared. Do they make a woman think twice about buying a bottle or taking a drink?
They apparently do. I can speak to that. There was a study last year in the that the University of Oregon did, a professor there did, and it was able to show that there was about an 11% decrease in the states that had the point-of-sale signs. There's currently about 24 states that have signs posted where alcohol is sold, and Michigan's not one of those.
Michigan is not one. So that is something. Mm-hmm. So what's being done in Michigan to make this happen?
At this point, it's more of an exploring of the process, I guess. It's one of my goals to look into that and see how I can further that. Legislation is kind of a new territory for me, so it's kind of a learn-as-I-go process. I'm trying to get a team together and have done some research on it and trying to figure out how to best approach that and move forward with that.
So, yeah, Julian's been just terrific. She's spearheaded this for the task force and has a group of people who are working on it. So you have to, you know, go through the legislative process, which would mean finding a legislator who would be willing to, you know, even discuss the issue and then put up some legislation to be voted on and see if we could get something going on. So Julian's done all this research. It's been great on how many, you know, what states are doing, what their signs look like, what their legislation said. So we're hoping to find a legislator that would be willing to work with us on this and go forward.
What kinds of initiatives exist right now in the state of Michigan?
So recently, there was a Michigan FASD coordinator appointed for FASD initiatives, and she started some pilot programs around family interventions, which have been found to be very effective if families are given the supports to deal with their children. And then we also know that there are different other interventions like social skills development. There's a particular math program for kids who have FASD. It's called SMILE. And there's other parent and child interaction programs that have been found to be evidence-based. And those can be found on the CDC website. And there are other prevention activities through the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, Maternal and Child Health as well.
Julian, as you've done all this research and you've lived this with your son, what's the sense of the social cost of FASD in Michigan?
Well, I think it affects every aspect of society. It affects schools, it affects the criminal justice system, it affects families, and it's something that's not understood. And I guess people don't understand fetal alcohol spectrum disorder as a disability. They think it's a behavior. And if we could start understanding it more as a disability, we might be able to make more progress in some of these areas and give people the supports that they need in schools and in prisons, in the legal system, and help people, you know, move forward and get their lives structured so that they can be productive.
And I can tell, Anne, you are singing amen to this, yes. Especially about it being not a behavioral issue.
Right, right. So, because that's often what people frame this as. So, and it's difficult if you're dealing with a child, say, in a classroom. It's not, but it's not the behavior. We have to really step back and say, hey, we have to change the way we think about this. How can we best support this child in the classroom? How can we best support this young adult as they start their work life? How can we best support, and what does that mean for us? And not blame the child for what's essentially, many people would call a head injury that happened before birth.
We're putting a link to the Michigan FASD Task Force up on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. It has a lot of information and links to resources on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And you've given us a lot to think about. Anne Corrales, Julene Lloyd, we want to thank you so much for raising our awareness of FASD.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, in the race towards autonomous vehicles, is Detroit in danger of getting lapped by Silicon Valley and the tech companies? Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. A former Michigan State University sports doctor is facing prison after allegedly abusing dozens of young patients and athletes. Now advocates, even some survivors, say MSU has a rare opportunity here. As Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, they want the school to use these stories to teach people how abuse happens and how it gets missed.
Larissa Boyce has good days and bad days. On the bad days, she can't sleep, or she has night terrors and she wakes up to a very startled husband. But today is a good day. We are out at her parents' house in rural Williamston. It's beautiful outside. Skylar, her three-year-old, is obsessed with his granddad's tractor.
We're all done with a tractor. All right.
Bye, Papa.
Oh, okay.
About 20 years ago, when Boyce was a teenage gymnast, she says she told her MSU coach that something was wrong. Dr. Larry Nassar, the Olympic team coach who also worked at the school, was putting his fingers inside her vagina and anus during treatment. But Boyce says her coach, Kathy Klagis, did not report it.
She told me that I was misunderstanding it and then took me through this whole process of trying to convince me that I was wrong or thinking of it wrong.
Klagis, for her part, has denied any knowledge of abuse. She stepped down from her post after a suspension from MSU earlier this year. And now Boyce wants MSU to use stories like hers about how even the most well-meaning people can fail to see abuse.
And I would love to see Kathy share with people about how he had fooled her and say, listen, these are the red flags. This is what happened to me. This is why I believed him over the gymnast.
Experts say that that is how child molesters get away with it. They are really good at getting us to like and trust them. And the best way to fight that is to do something pretty close to Boyce's idea. Have real people talk about their abuse and how adults missed it.
He was very charismatic. People liked being around him.
A lot of talk and Mr. Cool.
Very respectful.
Kind of like a grandfather.
These are voices from a documentary-style training. It's put on by Darkness to Light, a nonprofit focused on preventing child sexual abuse. And their CEO, Caitlin Brewer, says getting groups and organizations to do this kind of training can be a tough sell.
It is literally like jabbing a needle under people's fingernails because they don't want their brand associated with child sexual abuse. And if we do prevention training, then, you know, people are going to think that there's a problem.
But when places like Michigan State University are facing these crises, suddenly we have to talk about it.
Well, I think we have an opportunity. I really do.
Jason Cody is the university spokesman. He is the guy who has been handling all of the media intensity over the last year. We sat down on campus over the summer in a hot room with a loud fan. And he says, look, MSU is already tackling this head on. They are doing big reviews of athletic training, updating patient safety policies, rolling out more background checks. But the long-term focus, Cody says, is taking these lessons to a bigger community.
If there's a broadening of people's minds that we can do that will help prevent that, we of course are going to take every opportunity we can to help do that.
If that sounds like a vague plan, it's because things are complicated right now, Cody says. Nassar's criminal case is still playing out in courts, and MSU is in the middle of litigation with a lot of Nassar's alleged victims, including Larissa Boyce. Still, for her part, Boyce says if MSU ever wants her just to come talk about her experiences, tell students or staff how her abuse was missed all those years ago, she's in.
That would, redeem the situation, almost, at least a little bit, and show that they really do care and really want to change and be better than the other schools that have experienced this and be that example for everybody.
That is one thing that she and MSU say they agree on, that out of these horrific abuse allegations, now the school has an opportunity. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Detroit's automakers have a century's worth of experience and baggage, which has some analysts wondering how the likes of GM and Ford will rise to the challenge of self-driving technology. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. Morgan Stanley came out recently with some thoughts about this question and got right to the heart of it all, the very definition of the market itself, which is...
the wild, wild west. I mean, we haven't seen anything in the automotive space like what we're seeing right now, probably since the days of Henry Ford and Billy Durant, among others. In the state of California, there are 42 firms that have permits to test self-driving cars.
That's just in California.
Right. Just in California. So this whole notion that we want to think here in Detroit that General Motors and Ford are going to end up on top of this thing is by no means certain. I don't think anybody knows how this is ultimately going to play out. You're seeing some of the big tech companies come to the realization that building cars isn't as easy or cost-effective as they maybe thought it was a couple of years ago. So there is this sense that of different companies in different industries have different kinds of competitive advantages. I think in the case of Detroit, GM and Ford are trying to do as much as they can on their own from a proprietary sense because they believe that they can build the vehicles and they have that kind of expertise. Developing the software is a whole other kettle of fish. But it is really a crazy time right now, and there's a lot of very big money trying to figure out who to bet on, frankly. And the people they're really not betting on at this stage of the game are the Detroit automakers.
Is Morgan Stanley, you quote Morgan Stanley in your column about that instead of thinking of millions of units sold, you got to start thinking of trillions of miles traveled annually around the world.
Yep.
Haven't we seen GM and Ford making some big changes to adapt to that?
We have, but I think implicit in that phrase you just used is a real transformation from the internal combustion engine to electric powertrains. I think one of the things that the industry is starting to see, or at least envision, is that vehicles that they build that are autonomous, self-driving, have a lot of computer systems, a lot of sensing systems, LIDAR, radar, all sorts of things that enable them to move. How are those things going to be powered? They're going to be powered by electricity, not by gasoline, number one. Number two, an electric powertrain provides a lot of torque. It is able to provide power for all of those systems, and it has a lot fewer moving parts than an internal combustion engine. Therefore, the belief is it can last a lot longer. So the normal car or truck maybe is built to last for 150,000 miles, maybe more. But anybody who's owned a car for a really long time knows that over time, things start to really break down. There's a lot fewer moving parts in an electric powertrain, and therefore I think the belief is that those vehicles will last a lot longer. That has obvious implications for traditional automakers who have built a business on replacement, right?
Yeah.
They sell a vehicle, and at some point those vehicles have to be replaced. And one of the reasons we've had such a strong market in the last 7 years has been that the car park in the United States was getting progressively older, and therefore people had to replace their vehicles. But if you get into a situation where people are getting on their phone to get a ride to go to the Whole Foods, do their shopping, and then get a ride to go home and don't own the car, that has massive implications for the industry.
Are we seeing an example of Darwin's theory of natural selection playing out here?
That's an interesting question. I think to some extent, yes. What I think is also interesting is that there is nobody that's got the whole suite of technology and capability. Not the richest company in the world, which is probably Apple at this stage of the game. I mean, it could go out and buy what it needs, but it doesn't necessarily want to do that because it doesn't want to own things that don't create the kind of returns that its investors are accustomed to. But yes, I think you really are. And I think the real question for the car companies isn't the technology and the capability. Do they have the smarts, the engineering capability, the manufacturing capability? The real question I think investors are asking, and I think those of us who live here ought to be asking, is can these companies culturally do what needs to be done in something that is moving with incredible speed? These companies are not historically the kind of companies that move quickly. They don't take great risks. I think they're taking more risk today under their new leadership at General Motors and Ford particularly, in part because they don't have much choice. If they move more slowly, they're going to get eaten up. So you see them moving a lot faster, but the real question is, can they intuit and import, if you will, some of the cultural, corporate cultural values that you see in Silicon Valley companies?
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
The Las Vegas massacre has revived the outcry against the presence of certain guns in this country. But these calls for tightening gun laws or banning the bump stock that converts a rifle into an automatic weapon are focused on Congress. You're not going to see too much of an outcry in Lansing beyond a few tweets. That's because the gun control side lost Michigan over 16 years ago, according to our next guest. Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service is back to walk us through this moment in history. So, Zach, we're going back to 2000. It's less than a year after the mass shooting at Columbine High School. And at that point, Michigan was a may issue state, which meant what?
It basically meant that if somebody wanted a permit to carry a concealed pistol, they had to apply to their county gun board, and that gun board would decide whether you would get one or not. And some counties would give out the permits quite liberally, and others, it was very difficult to get a permit.
And the pro-gun activists and lawmakers were working very hard to make Michigan a shall-issue state,
right,
which flips to the other side of the coin, doesn't it?
Yes. Basically, that was designed so that anybody who had not been convicted of a serious crime, didn't have a history of mental illness, would get a permit if they applied for it. And they had to go through some training as well.
So they were crafting a law which would have done what?
Well, the law basically was to make Michigan a shall-issue state so that this limited number of people who had permits to carry a concealed pistol, now it would be open, much more open to folks, that they wouldn't be subject to the whims of their county gun board, that there would be, it would be much easier if you wanted to carry concealed, you could do that. And it had been sought after for many, many, many years. But finally, the political dynamics in the legislature lined up in the 1999-2000 term to make it happen. It was torturous. It was extremely acrimonious. But by the end of the year of the 1999-2000 term, Governor Engler, the governor at the time, did sign a bill into law to make Michigan a shall-issue state.
So we've got the pro-gun side trying to change Michigan's concealed weapon law and make Michigan a shall-issue state. But the bill stalled after passing the House and Senate?
It did. The shooting in Littleton, Colorado at Columbine High School really changed the whole dynamics of the situation. The state came under a lot of national scrutiny for moving a bill that would loosen concealed weapon permitting in the wake of this. Now, the shooting at the high school had nothing to do with concealed weapon permitting. However, there was a very intense debate as to whether those getting concealed weapon permits under the new law should be able to carry into schools. So it became really acrimonious. And eventually, Governor Engler and the leaders of the legislature decided the environment was just too toxic to move on the legislation. And it sat for really more than a year.
That is, and that was very rare, wasn't it, to have something
like
that?
Yes, you don't see a bill pass the House and the Senate with fairly substantial majorities and then just peter out and not make it to the governor's desk. It's very unusual.
And then comes November 2000, the election comes and goes, and it is lame duck. What happened then?
Well, the pro-gun forces decided now was the time. The election was over. They had the opportunity now to try to move the shall issue legislation, and they did. Now, it was changed quite a bit. The governor's office wanted a number of changes, but the bottom line was still the same, to make Michigan a shall issue state. What was added then was pretty substantial training requirements, and they did put in place the gun-free zones, so to speak, where schools, houses of religious worship, daycare centers, other sensitive venues, people could, with a concealed weapons permit, could not bring their pistol into those venues.
All right, so the legislature reworks this gun bill in lame duck, and then a moment in Michigan history, a tactic very familiar these days when lawmakers want to hurriedly get something through that they think could be unpopular enough to spark a voter referendum movement. So what happened for the very first time with this bill?
Well, the legislature added, I believe, $1 million to the Department of State Police to implement a portion of the law. And the reason that was very significant was the Michigan Constitution says that bills making appropriations to state institutions are not subject to voter referendum. And what had been percolating for some time was that the pro-gun control forces had been saying, okay, you guys go and pass what you're going to pass. We're going to put it up on the 2002 ballot for referendum. And challenge it because it was unclear whether this was going to pass muster with the electorate should there be a statewide vote. But by putting this funding in, the goal was to basically inoculate it from referendum. Now, the purpose of that language, prohibiting referenda on bills making appropriations to state institutions, was to prevent sort of zealots from paralyzing state government. So when you have all the bills making appropriations to fund the government, billions of dollars, you can't have that put up for referendum because the whole state government could be shut down for 2 years as a result. But the language was loose enough that maybe just adding $1 million would be good enough. And sure enough, it worked. A group went out and collected the signatures necessary to put the bill up for referendum in 2002, but a lawsuit was filed. And the state Supreme Court ruled that it was not eligible for referendum.
And that laid the groundwork for something that we've seen that happen a lot in recent years.
Yes. Yeah, it changed everything. It really ended the right to referendum under the Constitution.
And as far as the gun control movement and any effort to get Michigan back to being a May issue state, that fizzled out then, didn't it?
It did. What was surprising was the pro-gun control folks have been saying, you know, look, if we lose the ability to do a referendum, it's not over. We could pursue a voter-initiated act, which would be a totally new law. Referendum is an up or down vote mm-hmm. on what the legislature passed and the governor signed. But they could still pursue a citizens-initiated act. It would be a totally new law to accomplish essentially the same thing. But it just didn't happen. They said they were going to do it, but it just petered out. It was surprising to me because they had gone out and collected, I think, something like 230,000, 240,000 signatures for referendum. They would have needed to start from scratch, but they would have needed roughly the same, a little more, to get a cushion to do the voter-initiated act. They had law enforcement that had been with them on this. They had a lot of prominent funders with entertainment venues who were on their side, and they had put together this organization pretty much from scratch to go get these signatures, which is not easy, but it just simply never happened, and the momentum they had built up completely evaporated, and the pro-gun folks, they had the law they wanted, they had all the organization, and there's really been nothing since that has just changed that dynamic.
Fascinating look at Michigan's history in terms of gun control. Zach Gorchow, Gongwer News Service, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Sarah Leeson, Danielle Pryor, and Tyler Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.